Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. Newly reimagined for 2019, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Support for the morning show also comes from the University of Wisconsin Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management, a career for the benefit of people, the planet, and profits from UW Parkside in partnership with UW Extension. Details available at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And I'm very, very pleased to be able to spend this portion of the Monday Morning Show with Randall Tucker, who is Chief Inclusion Officer for MasterCard. So every time you pull out that MasterCard out of your wallet, Randall Tucker is part of that story as Chief Inclusion Officer. And he has served in that capacity with other companies as well. So this is something that is a very important concept to him and kind of the heart and soul of much of his professional life. He's coming to Carthage this Thursday, the 14th of March, to speak on the topic of inclusion. And actually the topic of his talk on Thursday is how MasterCard fosters a culture of inclusion and why it's good for business. And we're going to be talking about that for the next few minutes with Randall Tucker. And Mr. Tucker, I appreciate you making time in your busy schedule for our conversation, and we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much, Greg, for your invite.
So tell us, first of all, a little bit about where you are from originally and your background and how your background led you to a professional life that deals with matters of diversity and inclusion. Has that somehow been an important theme in your life from early on, or something that entered your life a little later?
Well, you know what? In hindsight, it has. And you asking the question kind of brought up a few memories for me. So I grew up on a farm in Southern Virginia. In Carson, Virginia, to be exact. And literally a train was running through the middle of the town. And I knew, even though I loved where I grew up, I knew that that was not going to be the place where I lived in my adulthood. And I had an opportunity after college, and I majored in hotel management as well as in marketing. And I had an opportunity to move to Washington, D.C., where I got the flavor of living in the big city life, so to speak, and I knew that that was home for me. When I was growing up, I'm a gay black kid that grew up on a farm, of course. Diversity has always been top of mind for me. Was it something that I thought about every day? No, but I know that difference does matter. And the way that I got into the diversity space was I took a leap. My background was in sales as well as in project management, and I had an opportunity within an organization to be a part of their diversity communications and community affairs team as the coordinator. I was a low man on the totem pole, and I got a chance to learn all three of those areas. And just through life and through experiences where people took chances on me, diversity and inclusion became my subject matter expertise. And so almost 20 years later, I've been able to build global strategy and have many different experiences around the world and doing this work that led from me taking a leap from that dirt road in Virginia that has led me to where I am now.
Great story. I know that before MasterCard, you were Senior Director of Inclusion and Diversity at Darden Restaurants, and I think that is a firm that operates a number of different restaurant chains that a lot of people would recognize. So that's just about as big a deal as doing what you do now for MasterCard. How common is it for corporations like Darden Restaurants or MasterCard to have somebody working there in your capacity? I mean, do most large companies have inclusion officers? And if so, how recent a phenomenon is this? At what point did companies begin to take this issue this seriously?
Right. And so I cut my teeth in doing this work at Starwood Hotels and Resorts, even prior to Darden. So that's where I actually learned the craft of inclusion and diversity. The evolution of diversity functions has evolved over decades, I would say. One from a compliance where the government has mandated certain requirements around hiring and from a supplier perspective of if you work for the government, can you account for making sure that all communities are involved in your process, to actually strategic around how do companies leverage differences of perspective to help drive business results and attract the best and brightest talent. So this this role has been in place in many Fortune 500 companies for decades. Just the focus of the work may have shifted based on the evolution of how organizations think about the work.
When you think about inclusion for a place like MasterCard, what kinds of inclusion or what kinds of diversity are you specifically talking about? And what are the issues that are, in a sense, especially important to you or especially crucial to give attention to?
Right. I think we have to first back up and define what we're talking about. And, you know, every organization has a different view of how they define diversity as well as inclusion. At MasterCard, we define diversity as all the things that make us both similar as well as different. Things you can see about folks, and then there's things you can't see about people. And none of us are a carbon copy of each other, and so therefore we're all diverse. When we think about inclusion, sometimes people just say diversity and inclusion, and they kind of lump it all together. But at MasterCard, it's a very specific definition around how well leaders are able to build diverse teams as well as keep them. I could have gone into a very much more scientific way of putting that, but in the layman's term, everyone can grasp how well are you able to build diverse teams and keep them. And so with that broad definition of diversity, the way that I do it globally is understand from a regional perspective, whether I'm in Asia Pacific or I am in our Middle East region or I'm in North America or in Latin America, that inclusion definition or that diversity definition looks a little bit different as to what things I'm tackling. So in the U.S., I might be tackling how do we increase the representation of people of color within senior level roles. Or in the Middle East, I might be working with how do you focus on nationalization if organizations are held to hire talent that is local to that region and not bring in expats. Or if I'm in Asia and we're talking about, you know, representation of women at senior level. So it depends on where I am in the world, where I'm able to parachute in, diagnose where some of the gaps are based on data and understanding where leaders want to go. That's what drives the conversation. So it's not what does Randall want to do. It's more of, I mean, listening to the organization and solving for things that the business sees as things that they want to tackle.
I'm so glad that you mentioned the fact that the work you do is of a global nature. And I wasn't sure when I saw that in your biography. Once in a while, we use the term globally to mean more sort of just comprehensively. We don't literally mean around the globe. And I think you're using that term quite literally, meaning that we're not just talking about here in the United States, but all over the world, of course, where MasterCard has a presence. It reminds me of something that came up recently about a certain Protestant church in the United States, or I mean, but it's actually a church that has a presence everywhere, that just had a vote regarding the gay and lesbian community, and it was a more conservative vote and let's say kind of an exclusionary vote than had been perhaps anticipated. And one of the things I read about why that church body voted as it did, in a way that was viewed as unkind to the gay and lesbian community, is because that church actually has quite a presence in other parts of the world that tend not to be as inclusively minded when it comes to gay and lesbians than we have come to be here in the United States. Not to be too simplistic, of course, there are plenty of people in the United States that have serious issues, but by and large, we have an openness here in the United States and a sense of justice for that community that is not present everywhere around the world at all. So, for instance, for you as Chief Inclusion Officer, when it comes to an issue like that, in other parts of the world that might not see something like that the way we tend to here in the United States, are you saying that it is left to the locals and their own culture and beliefs and customs to kind of shape the policy that that they will follow? Or is there kind of a happy medium between trying to be open to those possibilities and yet really staying faithful to certain bedrock principles that cannot be compromised?
Got it. So there's a lot to unpack there. And from your example, I think many organizations, many people are actually on their own journey around and being inclusive as well as diverse. But what I can say about MasterCard is that we do hold the rule of law in high regard to anything that we do as an organization, because that's the overlay of when we're in a certain part of the world, we must obey what law looks like. Because what we don't want to do, especially in the case of someone that's LGBT, do something that would expose them and put their life at some point in danger. Mm. But what I can say that is, if within the four walls of our buildings and our offices, we want to create safe space that no matter who you are, where you come from, what you look like, or what your wrapping is, that you are invited, welcomed, and respected within our organization. Now, it might look a little bit differently outside of the world because we can't sometimes control that, but we can control inside to make sure that everyone feels valued and respected.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Randall Tucker, who is Chief Inclusion Officer for MasterCard. We are speaking with him today because Mr. Tucker is actually going to be a special guest of Carthage College and giving a public presentation this Thursday, the 14th of March. And we're appreciative of Mr. Tucker making time in a very busy schedule to join us for a few minutes to talk about the importance of the work that he does at MasterCard. So you have been at this, that is the business of inclusion and diversity, for some years now. In general, in terms of the entire business sector, not just in the companies for which you've worked, although that's obviously where you have the most direct observational expertise, how would you chart the progress that has been made in terms of the matter of diversity and inclusion being taken seriously and implemented in meaningful ways? What kind of progress have we made over the last couple of decades?
You know what? Past couple of decades, I think that I can speak to the work that I've done that I think has been made progress. But I do applaud organizations that look at this work from a different lens of just compliance. I need to do this because the government is making me do it, to more of how do we think about all the variety of perspectives that are in the organization and how do you fully leverage those perspectives at each and every level of the organization, especially in senior level roles, in decision-making roles, where people are able to help problem solve as well as innovate based on their view of the world. And when you get all these people together, that's when you can have some really magical stuff happen. I think the progress from my perspective that I've been able to bring to organization is greater relevance. And I think greater relevance equals I'm helping you support your business strategy, as well as making sure that we formally understand what we're talking about. So when I kind of backed up and said earlier, this is how we define diversity, this is how we define inclusion, I think we all need to be on the same page with what we're talking about. Of course, I've had external recognitions where I've helped organizations to be top employers for diversity, whether it be the Human Rights Campaign or Diversity Inc. or Bloomberg, have been recognized for that. But I think the one thing that I have loved in my job is not taking a one-size-fits-all approach. So when I said this is what diversity and inclusion looks like in Asia versus North America versus in Europe, not taking a one-size-fits-all approach where everyone does the same thing, but making it make sense for that local region, because that's the work that I do with Global. And I think that in the efforts of trying to be diverse and inclusive, sometimes if we're not looking at the needs of the local area, we miss the point. Hmm.
You've touched on something I was very anxious to talk with you about, which is what are some of the commonly made mistakes when a company is trying to be serious about diversity and inclusion? And I'm sure mistakes get made all the time. And I suspect that one of the most commonly made mistakes is what you were just touching on, the idea of, in a sense, trying to do this very simply and rather bluntly by adopting some sort of one-size-fits-all policy that, in fact, does not necessarily fit various situations and various scenarios all that well. What else do you think companies tend to not do quite right, or what sorts of mistakes are commonly made by companies who are trying to do the right thing but maybe don't always do it in quite the right way?
You know what? I'm going to speak to myself and my learnings and how I've evolved as a leader. I think some of the things that I learned to do differently or to think about differently have been in my desire or in an organization's desire to be inclusive, not leaving anyone out of the equation, especially white straight men, because this work could easily have a slippery slope of we're focusing on those people over there or this group of people, instead of saying at the end of the day, all we're trying to figure out is what perspective is missing at the table. And so I am just as important and just as, you know, passionate about making sure the white straight guy is at the table as is the African-American woman or the LGBT employee. And I think that's something that's really important, because this work is a big turnoff to a lot of people, because they think that, you know, you're trying to weed them out of a conversation or out of a job. And so that is not the intent at all. The other thing is forcing people to do something or forcing the organization to do something that is not ready to do. It's a collaborative process. It's not a hammer approach where you're kind of beating your fist on the table saying we need more of this group or something like that. But it's more of let's figure out what are the data points that are leading to giving the organization the data that it needs in order to make an informed decision. And so that will chart where they want to go. And so not that bullying approach. And then again, as I said earlier, not that one-size-fits-all model where you actually look at from a regional basis what's most important to them. Mm-hmm.
I think when people from the outside looking in raise concerns or questions about matters of diversity in a given company, I think the concern that perhaps gets raised about as often as any is the possibility that somebody may be elevated into a position for the sake of diversity, for the sake of being inclusive, and it may be a position that in fact is not a great match for them, or they may be promoted beyond what their expertise or experience might otherwise suggest or warrant for the sake of diversity or inclusiveness. I think you know what I'm getting at here. What would you say to someone who raises a concern like that? And for instance, at a place like MasterCard, how do you shape your policy so those kind of mistakes that do not serve the company nor the person in question well, so those kind of mistakes are likely to be avoided?
You know, every organization I've been in that doesn't, you know, even at MasterCard, has been, we want to find the best and brightest talent. And we know that best and brightest talent comes in many different shapes and sizes and colors and backgrounds. And so that right there is no sacrifice for the quality of talent that we're trying to put into each and every level of the organization. And so one of the things that sometimes organizations do, I mean, that's their prerogative that they want to do it, but is in implementing quotas. And sometimes giving quotas, you know, it's sometimes hard for organizations to do that and then back up and say, well, we found the best person, but then you had some number to meet. And so in the implementation of something like a quota, sometimes organizations get into a corner where the person in the role was just put in the role just because they have a certain background. And so if that's the case, sometimes the organization doesn't get the talent that it needs. And then sometimes you set that person up for failure because they're not ready for the role. And that's not been the approach that I've had in any of my my roles in any organization, including MasterCard.
Hmm. A last question. You followed someone in this, I believe, this same position or largely the same position who had been at MasterCard for quite a long time. I'm just curious, when you came aboard, and I'm not sure exactly how long ago that was, but was it a case of taking solid policies that were already in place and just making sure that they continued to be implemented properly and maybe polished in the details? Or have there been any ways in which you have tried to reshape MasterCard's approach to matters of inclusion and diversity?
You know, I think, you know, even in organizations that I've left, I think it's more of a platform was created, and so it's a handing off of a baton to both reshape as well as continue work that had been done. And so that's a case of what happened within MasterCard. And so someone was in the role quite a few years. And even before that person, someone was in this role. I think it's just me adding my authentic as well as my expertise of how I know how to lead this work to you know, further drive inclusion and diversity progress within the organization.
Randall Tucker is Chief Inclusion Officer for MasterCard. And he will be coming to Carthage College this Thursday, the 14th, to give a talk titled How MasterCard Fosters a Culture of Inclusion and Why It's Good for Business. Randall Tucker, I really appreciate the time you've taken to speak with me, and I appreciate all that you do around this very important topic for MasterCard. We wish you safe travels and best wishes.
Thank you so much, Greg, and I look forward to being at the college next week.
Privileged indeed to be. Mr. Tucker's visit to Carthage College is made possible by MasterCard and by the Carthage College Chapman Executive in Residence Program. You can find out more information about his public presentation this Thursday by going to carthage.edu and finding On the Bridge a story about Mr. Tucker's visit. The presentation is free, but registration is required for attendance. The time is exactly 8:34. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. And here is part two of today's program from the Morning Show archives. I feel very privileged indeed to be able to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show with Dr. Alan Francis, the author of a very important book called Saving Normal, An Insider's Revolt Against Out-of-Control Psychiatric Diagnosis, DSM-5, Big Pharma, and the Medicalization of Ordinary Life. It is the contention of Dr. Francis that the field of psychiatry seems bent on what is sometimes called diagnostic inflation, that is, of creating mental disorders and naming them when in fact we're not talking about mental disorders or even abnormal behavior at all. It is Dr. Francis's contention that we need to embrace a wider swath of human experience and behavior as normal with all of its variations, and that it is a ruinous path to medicalize so many disorders, personal quirks, and so on. And one of the ways in which Dr. Francis can call himself an insider is that he comes from the field of psychiatry and actually played a major role in the formation of DSM-4, that task force, which we'll talk about in terms of what that means. He is now professor emeritus and former chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Duke University School of Medicine. And the book Saving Normal is available in paperback from William Morrow, an imprint of HarperCollins. Dr. Alan Francis, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you. I wish I could summarize my book as well as you did.
Well, I appreciate that compliment very much. Maybe we can begin by this intriguing choice of words in your subtitle where you call it an insider's revolt. In other words, you are not from the outside looking in. You consider yourself an insider, particularly because of the role you played in the formation of a manual called DSM-4. Tell our listeners what this manual is all about, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual.
Well, yeah, it sounds dry, but it's a book that has way too much influence. It's a bestseller every year. It sells hundreds of thousands of copies every year. And it sort of helps people decide what's normal and what's not, who will get treatment, often what that treatment will be, who will pay for it. And beyond the clinical, it's way too important in decisions about who gets what school service, who gets disability, who gets sent to jail versus psychiatric treatment. It's used in custody battles. People may not be able to get a license to fly a plane if they have a psychiatric diagnosis. It has a kind of powerful influence on all sorts of decisions way beyond its competence. It's become more important than is good for itself and for society.
You tell us in the book that there was a DSM-1 and a DSM-2, and then DSM-3, the third incarnation or third version of this manual, which emerged, I don't remember, but some decades ago.
1980, yeah.
Right. And what was it about DSM-3 that was so dramatic and important?
Well, no one before DSM-3 cared the slightest bit about psychiatric diagnosis. And it was made, you know, very radically, idiosyncratically. Two clinicians seeing a patient would come up with completely different answers, so the diagnosis is pretty much worthless. And that was destroying the credibility of psychiatry. What DSM-3 did was provide rules for the road, a set of criteria for each diagnosis, checklist of symptoms and behaviors and durations. And this meant that under ideal conditions, people could agree. Diagnosis made sense. The real surprise was that the public embraced this in the weirdest way, that before DSM-3, the predominant model in psychiatry was psychoanalytic, and people would be discussing their dreams at cocktail parties. DSM-3 caught the public imagination. It sold like crazy, and people began to diagnose themselves, diagnose their wives and bosses. It became a hot topic.
Hmm.
And then the drug companies really just grabbed it.
Right.
They saw in it a tremendous marketing device. Instead of having to push pills, they could push ills. They could push psychiatric disorders. And if they could convince the public that psychiatric disorder was everywhere, that it was a chemical imbalance, that it required a chemical solution, that would be the best way in the world to sell pills. And they have just made fortunes misleading people into thinking they had psychiatric illness.
Right. You write, DSM-3 was wildly overbought, both literally and metaphorically. To everyone's surprise, it became a perennial bestseller with hundreds of thousands of copies sold every year, many more than there are mental health workers. DSM-3 was the victim of its own success. It became the Bible of psychiatry to the exclusion of other aspects of the field that should not have been, but were, cast beneath its shadow. Explain to our listeners the role that you played in the task force charged with DSM-4, which would have been the next reworking of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. Tell us what your responsibilities were and what you sought to do.
Well, I was in charge of it, so I got to pick the people who'd be working on it, establish the method that we would use. And I was concerned about overdiagnosis then, and so we established a method that would, we thought, strangle change. Any suggestion that would lead to increased diagnosis had to mount all sorts of obstacles. And we felt successful in reducing the risks of the system. We had 94 suggestions for new diagnoses. We accepted only two of them. Both of them bit us in the rear end. I'll tell you about that later if we have time. But we felt at the time that we'd done our job. It turned out that there have been at least three major epidemics, fake epidemics, of mental disorders since DSM-4. So we failed. We thought we were successful in reducing the risks, but we failed. The three epidemics are ADHD, which has more than tripled since DSM-4 was published. Autism has gone up by about 40 times. The rate of bipolar disorder has gone up dramatically. And the different reasons in each instance, but the biggest and most preventable cause of diagnostic inflation, aside from the fact that the system is too loose, is the enormous power of drug companies to move mountains to get people to feel that they're sick. And in 1998, about 4 years after DSM-4 was published, they got this amazing freedom to advertise directly to consumers and to, you know, flood the airwaves, the internet, magazines with advertisements that had people who looked just like you and me, but it turned out, no, they had a mental disorder, and that mental disorders were easy to diagnose but often missed, that they were always a chemical imbalance that required a pill, and then they'd always end with, ask your doctor. Meanwhile, they'd be marketing the doctors like crazy with salespeople who were the most beautiful men and women this side of Hollywood waiters, and the doctors always had armed on their shelves a free sample of psychiatric drug, and the easiest way to get a patient out of the office quickly would be to give them a pill. It turns out that 80% of psychiatry now is not done by psychiatrists. 80% of psychiatric medicine is being prescribed by primary care doctors. And get this, 1 in 5 Americans are taking a psychiatric medicine. So 1 in 5 Americans are taking a psychiatric medicine, usually prescribed by a primary care doctor, often after a 7-minute visit, where everyone's primed to think that medicine is necessary. And the result is this ridiculous overuse of medication for people who basically often don't need it. And at the very same time, the cruel paradox is that the people who do need it, the severely ill, it's about 5% of the population, they can't get it. They can't get medicine. They can't get treatment. They often don't have a decent place to live. And the result is that we have 1 million psychiatric patients in prison, hundreds of thousands homeless. These are people who could be greatly benefited by adequate access to treatment, a decent place to live. They can't get it. At the same time, we're spending tens of billions of wasted dollars a year on psychiatric medication for people who'd be better off without it.
When you make that point in the preface of the book, you talk about this imbalance and of how way too much of our attention and the dollars and cents and time of medical care is given over to the normal worried well. You put that in quotes, the worried well. In other words, people who actually are normal but are persuaded to think of themselves as not normal because of one thing or another. And these normal worried well are absorbing so much of mental health care in our country at the expense, as you said, of those who desperately need such care and can't access it.
Now, I mean, I think a couple of years ago, the antipsychotics were amongst the best-selling, biggest revenue-producing drugs in Big Pharma's pocket. They were $18 billion for antipsychotics, $11 billion for antidepressants, almost $10 billion for drugs for ADHD. At this point, 6% of all kids are on an ADHD drug. 10% of teenage boys are on ADHD drug, often unnecessary. 1 in 4 women over 40 are on antidepressant. 4% of all teenagers are on antidepressant. It's just gotten way out of hand. It's actually outrageous how drugs are being misused in the general population and being withheld from the people who really need them.
One of the concerns you raise, beyond just the specifics of what is contained in DSM-5, the most recent version of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, is the fact that the process by which it took shape was to in your mind, to a far too much an extent, closed and secretive. Help us understand the process by which this manual gets put together and to what extent, indeed, it is a secretive process, and what way in which that contributes to this very serious problem that you're outlining.
Well, psychiatry is just a special case of all of medicine. Most guidelines for treatment and for definition of disease are created by professional associations. And professional associations have an inherent conflict of interest. Experts always want to expand their area. Sometimes there's a financial conflict of interest, but that's been overrated. The biggest problem is that experts have an intellectual and emotional conflict of interest. They come to believe the work in their area too much. They have an emotional attachment to their pet diagnoses. They worry greatly about patients who are missed because the criteria are too loose, too tight. They never worry about patients who will be mislabeled because the criteria are too loose. Experts always assume that their suggestions will be carried out under best practice conditions, and very often suggestions made in guidelines are carried out instead in worst practice conditions. There's nothing worse than making a psychiatric diagnosis in 7 minutes by a primary care doctor. The moment of getting a diagnosis can be a change point in a person's life. It can be a great thing if the diagnosis is necessary, is it accurate and the treatment is necessary. It can be a terrible thing if the diagnosis is inaccurate and may haunt the person for life. The act of diagnosis should be taken enormously seriously by everyone concerned. It's like buying a house or getting married. It's usually not. And experts don't understand that. So they will make up a set of criteria that might work for them, but will be disastrous when the drug companies can market it to primary care doctors. And so one of the things I suggest is that we shouldn't allow the experts in the field, not just psychiatry, diabetes experts shouldn't be allowed to define diabetes by themselves. You need their input, but they shouldn't have the final say. Hypertension doctors will tend to always lower the blood pressure that's abnormal. You need to have a kind of broader outlook that doesn't allow the professionals, the experts in the field, to call the final shots.
Hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Alan Francis and talking about his book, Saving Normal, An Insider's Revolt Against Out-of-Control Psychiatric Diagnosis, DSM-5, Big Pharma, and the Medicalization of Ordinary Life. Dr. Francis, I want you to, I wish we had the time to really delve into this particular chapter in much greater detail because it's so interesting. Chapter 2 of your book, From Shaman to Shrink, essentially traces the history of the whole notion of psychiatry and of the way in which emotional and mental disorders and problems have been confronted over the centuries, and it's really fascinating to see what I'm not sure is exactly a straight line of progression or evolution, but certainly it is a fascinating, rich, colorful history, and also sometimes really, really troubling in terms of the way in which humankind has tried to grapple with these issues at a time when there was no science whatsoever to support them. I guess my main question is, what is important about knowing this history in terms of understanding this present crisis that you describe in the rest of the book? How does that history have a bearing on the present situation that confronts us?
Well, there are two theories about this. One is, if we don't know history, we're doomed to repeat it. And the other is that all we learn from history is that we never learn from history. But I think it's inherently interesting, and it does have important lessons. One is that there have been constant fads in the way we've understood human behavior, going back to the shaman. that my guess is that people don't change much, that human nature is a very, very sort of solid given. But the way we understand human nature, the way we understand symptoms, can change radically. It has changed radically over the days. The shaman thought that it was someone violating a taboo and having the spirits angry. The priest thought it was the gods that were angry. Demons inhabiting the person would account for the aberrant behavior. We've had a million different psychiatric models over the ages, and often these led to horrible treatments. Most of the treatments that were given to psychiatric patients, often well-meaning, but often poisonous and toxic. The lesson is that we should be very suspicious of any new idea, that any time lots of patients suddenly have a diagnosis, that means it's being overdone. If we get a tripling of ADHD, it's not doesn't mean that kids have more ADHD symptoms. It means that we've relabeled them. When the rate of autism goes up by 40 times, that doesn't mean that kids shouldn't be vaccinated because there's an epidemic of autism. It means that we've relabeled the definition of autism to make it much more inclusive. And we should be looking for the society reasons and the professional practice reasons whenever there's an increase in rates, not imagining that the people have changed. Mm. I think once you get to skepticism, whenever it seems like everyone has a new diagnosis, that means that probably lots of people are getting it, don't have it. You become much more cautious in your therapeutic interventions and much more careful in the way you label people.
Hmm. One of the most intriguing points you make, I think, in the book is helping us understand the human need to label, to name. And the fact that we almost seem wired to do this, and this is a particular field in which we seem especially hungry, and maybe it is because of the kind of intangibility of the typical mental illness or emotional disorder that naming it, giving it a title, putting it in a book, listing a criteria of symptoms and so on, sort of gives us a handle by which we can maybe approach and confront and potentially treat these disorders, which can otherwise be so bewildering, so disconcerting. Can you talk a moment about this urge we have to name and why that it is especially present in this arena?
You know, I think that the human condition isn't easy, never has been. We've always struggled with external traumas and stresses and difficulties and with internal symptoms and reactions that were puzzling and disturbing. You take a patient today who has psychiatric symptoms, and if you label them accurately, it's a wonderful moment. I mean, I think the best moments I've had in psychiatry are with people who've come in the worst day of their lives, feeling that there's no way of understanding their problems, that they're uniquely damned, and that they're doomed to a future of continuing distress. And explaining in simple matter-of-fact, this isn't rocket science terms, what the problem is and how we understand its causation, what's the likely prognosis and course, and how we can improve it with treatment. And at the end of 45 minutes, a person's life looks completely different. They go from being alone and misunderstood to having a sense of optimism about the future. It's a very satisfying moment to the patient, very satisfying for me or any person who's participated in something like this. The trouble is that very often the education and the labeling is done by someone who doesn't have much expertise and spends 7 minutes doing it, and it's too influenced by drug companies. Under those circumstances, the diagnosis is often wrong. And once given, has a life of its own. That once you get a diagnosis, it's very hard to eliminate. It tends to live in the chart. It lives in your mind. It lives in other people's minds. And if it's inaccurate, it can lead to disastrous downstream consequences. So the tendency to label is a way of controlling what otherwise feels uncontrollable. It's a useful way. It's the way we cognitively shape our world. But it can also lead to premature closure around wrong answers that will cause much more harm than good.
Hmm. You make an important point that psychiatry is not alone in this kind of overreaching. it is just one example of what you call the bloat and waste that characterizes all of U.S. medicine. When it comes to confronting it, does this particular issue present enough unique challenges that it needs to be attacked in sort of a unique way versus through other avenues that would seek to sort of revise and reshape the overall medical system in this country?
Well, I was just at a meeting of the National Guideline Network, and very, very happy about the fact that they're going to begin an effort to provide guidelines for guideline makers that will restrict the wild overdiagnosis of disease by restricting the freedom people have to change the definitions. This is, of course, all of medicine. I was only a psychiatrist there. But I think that the psychiatry alone can't reform itself, but all of medicine is bloated, especially in the U.S. We spend almost two times as much as many other similar countries on medical care and have worse outcomes. We don't do well in terms of overall outcomes, although we're spending fortunes. And the reason for it is we're spending these fortunes in the wrong way. We're over-testing and over-treating. Psychiatry is a very small part of this, of course, all of medicine. And I think that there's going to be a rebound, partly because we can't afford to do this anymore. 18% of our GDP is going to medical care. Can't afford that this go up to 25%, which is going to happen unless we get control of the way we're doing things. But also partly because there's a strong realization that over-testing can cause harms. The prostate situation is the best example. All men were recommended to get prostate testing after age 60. No one should get it unless they have a family history or other risk factors, because it turned out that we were discovering lots of prostate cancers that weren't going to change the person's life, that should have been left alone, but that discovering them resulted in all sorts of invasive treatment. People died at the same age they would have died without the test, but they had a much less satisfying life along the way because the treatments were so invasive and difficult. I think that psychiatry is just one special case of a massive commercialization and over-treatment in all of medicine, and we have to come back to common sense, not just in my field, but in the others as well.
And, of course, come to a better understanding of what it means to be normal, and your book spends a long time dealing with that matter as well. And all of the other specific and interesting details that are part of this very, very alarming situation. The book, again, Saving Normal, is a paperback from William Morrill, an imprint of HarperCollins. Dr. Alan Francis, thank you so much for writing this important book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Well, thank you for being the perfect reader and a terrific interview. This is really interesting.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I am very excited to welcome into our studios a Kenosha's own Paul Cortese, a very, very gifted violist who has had a long, distinguished career in Spain, but is back in Kenosha this week and will be performing this coming weekend with the UW Parkside Orchestra under the direction of Alvaro Garcia. On Wednesday, more musical matters. I'll be speaking with Carthage's Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli, director of the Carthage Choir, and Argentinian composer Martin Palmieri. This weekend, the Master Singers of Milwaukee, under the direction of Dr. Garcia Novelli, will be performing Palmieri's Misa Tango. Nan Calvert pays her monthly visit to the program on Thursday. On Friday, Jonathan Carmel, author of an interesting new book called Dying to Work, Death and Injury in the American Workplace. We remind you that WGTD's morning show is now available as a podcast. So if that is a more convenient way for you to listen to the show or to catch up with shows you have missed. We invite you to go to any podcast platform and you will find The Morning Show with Greg Burke. Otherwise, it is archived, of course,